up in the morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule. American history and practical math. You study them hard, hoping to pass. Working your fingers right down to the bone. And the guy behind you won't leave you alone. Ring, ring, goes the bell.
Hello, everyone. My name is Leonie Hampson. Welcome to our show, Talk Out of Schools, on WBAI Radio 99.5 FM, where we focus on issues affecting public schools here in New York City, the state level, and nationally. Our show is also available for download or as a podcast. Today, I have two special guests talking about the reopening of schools here in New York City and the effect of the COVID pandemic on schools nationally. First, I'll be interviewing Kim Watkins, a parent leader, who will explain how many New York City schools still do not have school nurses, which is a huge problem if they are to reopen safely. Then I'll interview Johan Niems, professor and author of a recent op-ed in USA Today about how the COVID school shutdowns may lead to a loss of support for public education and a further privatization of the system, at the same time when many parents are for the first time fully appreciating the incredible job our public school teachers do when schools are normally operating. But first, some news. Late on Friday, the New York City Department of Education released the outline of a plan for school reopening in the fall to be submitted to the State Board of Health. They promise more details at the school level will follow. They released a rubric and protocol for individual school closures if COVID cases emerge among students or staff, that if two cases emerge in a classroom, the entire class will close and students and their teachers will quarantine for 14 days. If two cases emerge in different classrooms, the entire school will shut down for that amount of time. The mayor also announced that he will not reopen schools unless the positivity rate citywide remains under 3% by early September, while the governor's benchmark is a less restrictive 5%. As of today, the city's rate is 1%, one of the lowest in the country. According to the governor, there have been no COVID deaths in New York City for 3 days in a row. The DOE is also letting parents decide whether they want to keep their children home for 100% remote learning next fall. Parents need to decide by this Friday, August 7th, by registering their decision online. If you don't have the link for this, you can go to the New York City Public School Parent Blog, where I posted it. Families can change their mind to choose full-time remote learning at any time. But if they alter their original choice to opt in for in-person learning, this can happen only a few times a year. Whether they should keep their kids home 100% of the time will be a difficult decision for many parents, especially as much information is missing in the DOE's reopening plan, which does not say whether all schools will have nurses, doesn't say how widely available busing will be, and doesn't allow parents to even know how many days per week their kids will be able to attend school if they opt in for in-person learning. The disparities across the city regarding how little in-person learning will be available result from the awful inequities of class size and school overcrowding that plague our public schools. Parents also do not know what full-time remote learning will look like at their school and whether it will be improved from the version their children were subjected to this spring. The model used in summer school has apparently not gone well, according to interviews with students and teachers in the Daily News. Rather than the DOE's current plan, with all students offered blended learning and attending school only 1 to 3 days per week, other officials, including City Council Education Chair Mark Traeger and public advocate Jemani Williams, issued proposals recommending that DOE should focus in-person instruction on elementary school children and those students with special needs, English language learners, and living in temporary housing. This makes sense, as children under 10 are believed to transmit COVID less effectively, and the youngest students generally do worst with remote learning. If middle and high school buildings were closed with their students engaging in full-time remote learning, then younger students could theoretically be provided with more space for smaller classes in those buildings and attend school nearly full-time if there were enough teachers. Neither the UFT nor the CSA are fully satisfied with current plans, and their opposition may prevent schools from opening at all. Infection rates may also rise higher and above 3% before September or later as the fall progresses, with schools closing at that point. But at least some schools may then have the chance to meet their teachers and each other in person before that happens. As Dr. William Hanaj, an epidemiologist at the Harvard School of Public Health, wrote, recent interview, he said, "I think it's of great importance for teachers to be able to bond with students if they're going to be teaching. It's going to be really hard for them to do that online. If community transmission early on is sufficiently low, I do hope that's going to be possible for teachers to actually meet with their students in person for at least enough time they can form a bond, because even though we can anticipate there's going to be more transmission and schools may have to close again, those few weeks may end up being vital." But now let's go to our first guest, Kim Watkins, a parent leader who raised the alarm about the fact that not all schools have nurses, even before the pandemic hit. Kim, are you there?
I am. Good morning, Lainey. How are you doing?
Good morning, Kim. Thank you so much for joining us. Yes, I can hear you fine. How many schools do you estimate don't have nurses now? And what brought you to this issue originally?
So the estimate that I have that's most recent, around a week sort of a delay of information, but I'm working with a couple of nurses to help me stay updated on this number, and the estimate is around 700 schools without nurses. So that is a 75% spike in vacancies since the beginning of the pandemic. It was around 400 back in the spring and has hovered around that number for a fairly long time. And the reality is that this 700 number may also increase because nurses are also able to apply for accommodations. They're still coming in. They're the accommodations due to age, pre-existing health conditions, and so on. And something that's really important to note here is that our school nurses do not feel safe in terms of the plans that they are also reading about in the DOE's submitted documents and in the media. They don't feel like they have enough appropriate PPE. They don't think that social distancing guidelines are practical in terms of the school situations that they know they will face. And they know that isolation rooms aren't practical in many of our New York City school buildings, which are already really crowded. They were completely, our school nurses were completely left out of the reopening discussions, which is incredible. So the vacancy numbers reflect this complex set of issues that dedicated essential workers in our school communities have actually been dealing with for far longer than the pandemic existed, but for sure in a magnified way now. So the DOE
so
committed back in the spring.
Go ahead, sorry.
I was just going to say.
I was going to say 700 out of 700 out of 1,800 schools. Is that right? Don't have nurses now.
Correct.
Your estimate.
That's correct.
Okay,
that's correct. And the number's a little fluid, just because the in addition to the fact that we have 1,800 schools, we also there are nurse mandates for students that have required one-to-one nurses. There are child care centers and the school, the Office of School Health and public school nurses also serve charter schools and Catholic schools and various other kind of moving target numbers. So 700 is the estimate in relation to 1,800 total nurses needed. And back in the spring, we were told that there was a commitment by the DOE that there would be a nurse in every school. But what that means is that the system will be having to staff these schools with substitute nurses, nurses that are not employed by the school system, which I know we're going to get to in a couple of minutes. But the other point is that even pre-COVID-19, with all of the employees and contract nurses that are kind of in and out of the system, 50 school sites every single day in the spring estimated did not actually have a school nurse in the building at all, right? They had to share a nurse with another school building that was close by. So what that means, that is, like, if a nurse called in sick or didn't show up for work, a principal would have to make a decision, you know, if a child in the building who has a mandated medication mandate, the principal would have to decide to call the parent and let them know that a nurse wasn't going to be in the building. That type of situation is even magnified more now.
And so it's worse off now because many nurses have either retired or decided to take other jobs or simply don't feel comfortable going and working at schools the way they did in previous years. Is that right?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the lack of reference to school nurses in terms of the talking points with the reopening plans is significant because of that issue and because of this issue that already had been festering for such a long time pre-COVID. You know, with these 50 schools that didn't have a nurse at all, it meant that thousands of students attended schools without immediate care. And though the law does not require we have a nurse in every building, all buildings did have a nurse because of implicit requirements due to various medical conditions. And the DOE isn't even complying with this mandate in terms of one-to-one nurse mandates, and it's being sued right now by the American Diabetes Association as a result of a various number of families who have not been getting the mandated nursing required services that that their medical conditions require. So the statistics, the numbers, what we have right now are dire and really stark, but it does appear that it's going to be worse when we reopen or if we reopen.
So, first of all, are you convinced that there will be enough temporary contracted nurses on staff? And secondly, what difference does it make in general whether a school has a contract nurse or a permanent nurse on staff?
Well, that's a really good question. The first part is, am I convinced? I'm not at all convinced. I think had we really been focused on making sure that there was a nurse in every school, whether it be even a contract nurse or one of the employee nurses, and there are two types of nurses. Again, I know we're going to get to that in a second, but either way, the health professional in the school building is you know, kind of, to those of us who've been paying attention to this issue, is not being talked about by the reopening plans, not being talked about within the DOE leadership or at the city level. And that tells me that they don't see it happening. What it tells me is that they're going to try to figure out a way for there to be someone close by. And most of the nurses that are working in the system right now truly believe that schools will not have a nurse, that they will be handling, school nurses will be handling multiple sites if a reopening, an in-person reopening happens. And then, I'm sorry, what was your second question again? Why does it matter?
What difference does it make? Yeah, whether if they have a temporary contract nurse or a permanent nurse on staff, what's the difference?
So there are a couple of different kinds of there's basically an employment cast that has been created over many years of neglect that has a lot to do with the government placing a low priority on essential workers. I mean, we really just have to face that fact. Nurses haven't been paid a living wage, haven't been paid well. And as a function of the expanded number of schools in the DOE, and as a function of the number of school nurses needed because of medical conditions, the 600 DOE nurses that are employed by the Department of Education are the nurses who have a salary. They're represented by UFT, and they have they work the school year, and they have great benefits and a pension, and so on. But the as a result of this sort of expansive need for nurses, a lot of other public health nurses are employed by the Department of Health. And the Department of Health nurses are employed by the government, but they are not salaried nurses, and they work the full year. They work hourly. They're represented by a union as well, by DC 37, but they also have a different sort of pay structure, and it's not as it is not as high as the pay for the DOE. So those two kind of levels of caste create a bit of a structure where there's a waiting list to get into the DOE, and there is always a hiring. There's always a sort of a dearth of candidates trying to be hired into the Department of Health. But because of that, and this was a practical beginning, which was because of absences and vacations and so on, the government started hiring private vendors to substitute in when they needed them. And this was an expense that the city, had maintained over many years that was somewhere between $10 and $30 million a year. And over the last, say, decade, this has been a ballooned level of staffing because we have continued to struggle to keep nurses employed because of the low pay and because of the demand on the school nurse profession itself. So when a substitute nurse is used in place of an employed nurse, what is striking to those of us who are parents who are really concerned about like what happens during the day in our school, that school nurse doesn't have a relationship with anyone in the building, likely, most likely. The level of training, which is approximately 6 weeks in terms of sort of integrating a new nurse into the way that the DOE functions, the conditions that you deal with in terms of day-to-day clinical visits and day-to-day needs of children at various ages and the compassion that is required of someone working in that environment. That's a 6-week training program for employees, and it basically boils down to about 2 hours worth of time for a substitute nurse that comes in via a vendor. So there's a quality of care difference, a big one. The other part is that the employed nurse is going to have access to all online health records. And there's a program that was written, it's a New York City born and bred program called ASHER, the Automated Student Health Record System. And vendor contracted nurses are not filling in that information. They are not given access to that information, to that system. So when they see a clinical visit, when they see someone, they manually log in a book that they've seen a student. But they do not put in a record into the online health record, and that ASHER online health record system actually feeds into the city's syndromic surveillance data, which informs our entire government about the movement of diseases and conditions that are happening at the ground level. So it's a really, really important point to make that we need full-time nurses employed by our system in terms of all of our schools.
And if we were willing to pay them more and give them benefits, there's little doubt in your mind that we would be able to get the nurses that we need. Is that what you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's amazing that this has been allowed to fester for such a long time. We have been talking about this. I'm a member of the Community Education Council in District 3, and we have been talking about this issue for 2 years. Some of the nurses have been raising this alarm bell for almost 10 years because they knew that when it comes to, a nurse with a salary versus a nurse who's paid, hourly versus, a hospital like an ER nurse or a private hospital nurse who might make up to, $90,000 a year. Actually, private hospital nurses estimate $4,000 a year, the $40 an hour or the top rate, which is $65 roughly an hour for DOE nurses, is pales in comparison. So the employment pool is, always shifting because it's so expensive to live in New York City. We need to pay our essential workers a living wage, and our nurses should be able to live in the city where they serve, and our government has just let this issue sweep it under the rug, let it go, and chosen to hire private vendors, which I might add, it just is, as we're talking about the way we pay people, we pay the vendor $90 an hour. I think that was in a recent article in the news that the $90 an hour was the amount we were paying for private nurses. But that's $90 we're paying to the company. They're not paying that nurse $90 an hour because the company takes a cut. So we need to solve the actual problem instead of just sort of chipping around at the edges and saying we're going to have a body in each building, which we're not even doing that.
So I guess it's pretty obvious to everyone, including our listeners, that this issue is even more important now than ever. that the pandemic has hit our schools, and we need trained nurses in every school to deal with the possibility of an infected student and correctly record that and make sure that the school knows about it, the public health system knows about it, and the school can take whatever measures necessary to ensure that the infection does not spread. What does the DOE's plan that was released on Friday say about this issue, if anything?
One word, nothing. If you look at the DOE's plan, the word nurse isn't mentioned. It's fascinating, right?
Yeah,
I couldn't believe it. It refers to, you know, the plan refers to testing staff and teachers. It refers to suggested testing to students and temperature checks. It refers to the situational closures, as you introduced this morning, if a student or a staff member tests positive. But it actually doesn't make any mention of the assumed staff person who would perform this role. And in conversations I've had with school nurses in the last couple of weeks, and there have been so many of them, one of the, and even, you know, just to sort of harken back to your earlier point about like how summer school is gone and how the rec centers operated during the spring after we closed the school system down, the nurse in the building is the person that you go to, like if, you know, a child sneezes and has dropped his or her mask or refuses to wear a mask, or if, someone doesn't feel well, and then the whole classroom knows and everyone is really kind of on pins and needles, like the tension in the air is going to center around what happens in that nurse's office. And so during this next phase, whatever it's going to end up being, the individual in the school building who is, you know, talking to the principal, helping kids, and social distancing. Remember, social distancing is going to be really hard. Nurses hug their students and, you know, have to help them, you know, wipe their faces. And, you know, like there's a lot of interaction that makes it a really high risk job. And so the nurse is at like the centerpiece of the next phase if we truly care about the health of our school communities. And so the fact that they're not mentioned in the reopening plans at all, I think is a real indicator of where the school's real priorities are, where the school system's priorities
Absolutely.
Are.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I just saw a new UFT teachers union petition last night that included the demand that every school have a nurse. I was glad to see that in the petition. Thank you so much, Kim, for joining us. This issue is so critical for the reopening of schools next year and in general for every school to have a school nurse. So I really appreciate all the advocacy you've done around this, and I really appreciate you coming on the show today.
Well, thank you, Lainey. You know you can get in touch with me if you have any more questions. Have a
Absolutely.
Great day.
Thank you. This is Lainey Hameson, host of Talk Out of School on WBAI FM 99.5 or WBAI.org. Our show is available as a podcast if you missed the live version. We will be back in a couple minutes talking to Professor Johan Neem about how the switch to remote learning and school shutdowns due to the pandemic may lead to the end of public education as we know it nationwide. So stay right here.
Drop the coin right into the slot. You've got to hear something that's really hot. With the one you love, you're making romance. Wanting to dance, feeling the music from head to toe, round and round and round you go. Into the slot. You gotta hear something that's really hot.
This is Lainey Hampson, host of Talk Out of School. Hello, Professor Neem, are you there?
Thank you for having
Professor
me.
Professor Neem? Oh, thank you so much for coming on our show. Professor Neem teaches history at the Western Washington University and is an author of Democracy, Schools, The Rise of Public Education in America. You recently wrote a very provocative and rather scary op-ed in USA Today that started this way: "We might be entering the last days of public education in America." Can you explain what you meant by that?
Yeah, thank you. What I meant by that was we're hitting a moment with the pandemic where longstanding policy goals like charter schools or school vouchers are meeting a crisis faced by parents where they don't know whether there will be public schools this fall, and if the schools are open, whether they feel safe sending their kids there. And so they're starting to try to think about alternatives like pods or what are called micro schools or homeschooling or all kinds of things. And so the pandemic and these policy goals kind of meet up to create a crisis.
So one of the things that was really interesting in your op-ed is that you pointed out that the U.S. was the first country to expand access to public education to both boys and girls in the 1800s, but now may become the first wealthy nation to abandon that commitment. But in the U.S., education has always been a local and state effort. Isn't that true? And that emphasis on local funding has in itself led to inequities of resources and unequal conditions in our schools. Is that right?
That is right. I mean, the story is a little more complicated than that. I think that the localism of our schools has been both a strength and a weakness. The strength is that the way public schools work, I mean, we're a society that doesn't always like to pay a lot of taxes for public goods. But because schools were local and people mm-hmm. sent their own kids there, they were willing to invest in them. And so localism actually helped schools take off. But the result has been, as you point out, real inequalities between school districts. And parents, of course, have moved. Parents who have had the ability to move across district lines for their kids have increased that inequality over time. So both of these things are true simultaneously, right? That the public schools are unequal, but the fact that most Americans started to send their kids to the public schools maintained a broad commitment to using tax money to pay for education.
So in the past decade or so, public schools have been underfunded. The last great recession caused for a big loss of state funding, especially for public schools, and they've been under attack as leaders in both parties have pushed for school choice, especially charters and vouchers. This first happened in a major way under President Obama and Secretary Arne Duncan. Is that right? How did they push for privatization?
Yeah, I mean, it's not necessarily true that it first happened under the Obama administration, although charter schools were definitely part of the Obama vision in Race to the Top and other policies and in rhetoric. But the first, I believe, the first federal legislation supporting charters was during the Clinton administration, and then things like school choice and voucher programs took off under the Bush administration. And the ideas go back even earlier. But I think what you really need to know is what's happening at the state level. You need to look at the influence of foundations like Gates. You need to see that there's a lot of variety between states. You know, Arizona and Betsy DeVos's Michigan are very liberal in the sense that they allow all kinds of schools, including for-profits, to exist, while other states like Washington and Massachusetts are much more regulated in what they permit and how. But the issue to me is really this. The issue to me is really this, right? And this is what I was concerned about in the midst of this pandemic, is mm-hmm. that if we think of education as a collective public good, we need to make sure that most of us are stakeholders in that public good. If a lot of us start opting out, whether it's through private school vouchers or it's because the pandemic has forced us to make choices that are very difficult ones, but if parents start to choose to opt out, particularly privileged parents, we may lose that collective responsibility. And I think that in particular has been one of the goals of Betsy DeVos, who sees public education primarily as a family responsibility, not a civic collective responsibility.
Right. So even before the pandemic hit, there was a clear push by the Trump administration and Betsy DeVos to provide more money for school vouchers in the form of tax credit legislation. But all this has worsened as DeVos first mandated that districts should divert millions of dollars in CARE funds that were meant for public schools to send them to private schools. And now the Trump administration and the Republicans in Congress are pushing for public schools to reopen, whether or not they're safe to do so, and threatening to take funds away from them if they don't reopen in person. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that is absolutely right. And I think it's, in a way, whether the intent is to force a crisis or not, it is forcing a crisis for public education that is or could be existential, right? That if parents suddenly, well, whatever their politics, you know, whatever their commitment to public education may be in the abstract, now find themselves mm-hmm. on their own, they're going to act as if they're on their own. And they're going to do, and the parents who have money are going to build alternatives because they're not going to allow their kids to flounder. And the problem is that's going to increase inequality. Other kids will be left behind, or parents who can will start investing in alternatives, and our public schools will lose both the money and the commitment that comes from those parents being in it. Now, I think you're right that this is, you know,
yes.
This is the Trump administration's larger goal is to increase the right of families to choose the school for their child and not to have schools be public in the way we understand public or have historically understood public.
What's ironic to many of us is that before the pandemic hit, Betsy DeVos was going around the country and promoting online learning as a great option for parents. online learning, you know, in the form of charter schools or private schools is mm-hmm. a form of privatization. Even the use of privately purchased ed tech programs is a form of privatization of our schools in the delivery of education. But now she, along with Trump, have sort of reversed their opinions and have said that if public schools want to engage in online education, it's completely inadequate and we should pull their funding. So it seems like a huge amount of hypocrisy to threaten public schools that are already underfunded with a loss of funds if they engage in a modality of learning, which she had originally promoted. One of the things that I've seen in the suburbs, which are sort of in New York State, in Long Island and elsewhere, which are sort of the swing districts there, where the independent voters are, that they aren't necessarily strongly Republican or strongly Democratic, is that there is a move among parents to create these pods and to hire
right.
tutors or teachers to personally instruct a bunch of kids when they're at home, either to supplement what's happening at the school level or to replace it. Can you explain a little bit more about that?
Yeah. I mean, I think what's happened is parents are put in an impossible situation, especially, I mean, all parents, poor, rich, mm-hmm. White, black, brown, all parents, right, want their kids to be safe and want their kids to be able to learn. The Trump administration, I don't think it's a, you know, I don't think it's a partisan statement to say the Trump administration completely botched America's response to the pandemic. But the result is we're stuck here as parents, and I'm a parent, and I feel this tension, and I see, I mean, friends of mine have been asked by other parents, would they be willing to teach a group of kids, you know, that parents who have money are saying, okay, the online thing didn't work that well in the spring. And if the school's open, I don't want to send my kid because I'm not sure it's safe, but I don't want to give them, I don't want them to fall behind. So I have the money, or I can pool money with my neighbors and friends, and let's hire a tutor, kind of like, you know, the aristocrats of the 18th century would have done. Or let's form our own, let's buy things online and let's supplement them. People are doing this out of love and care and out of concern for their kids. But the result will be not only greater inequality between the kids who get these new things, but also parents may decide, you know what? Why am I paying all these school taxes for these other things when I've developed this other thing for my kid? And that is my concern, right? That we're pushed into this moment where parents' short-term decisions that they may just have to make because of the pandemic and the way America has failed to respond to it will have long-term consequences for our commitment to public education.
So I've seen recently that there's Silicon Valley startups that are launching businesses focused on providing pods and teachers to groups of parents that want to hire them to fill the vacuum of what the public schools cannot afford to provide. There are also private schools. I saw an ad for one yesterday that is offering remote learning along with the school sending a teacher to the student's home to teach them individually for $68,000 a year. And can you explain how this trend may lead to increased political pressure on states and the federal government to loosen up the purse strings when it comes to vouchers for families to be able to afford this?
Yeah, I mean, I think, one, we should, you know, we should step back and say, do we want for-profit companies determining what we offer our citizens in a democratic education? What kind of education will they offer? Why is education a market good when it's supposed to be a public good? So we should question what Silicon Valley is doing and trying to profit off of our tax dollars and our kids and take away control over the curriculum from citizens on the face of it. But the problem will be this, right? Schools, when people do things, they develop interests, and those interests become embedded. So if over the next year a sufficient number of families and companies become invested in buying services from Silicon Valley companies or buying services from private schools, and they're putting money towards it, and they want to keep that going, they're going to ask for policies to support them. And if the policies give a little, then more people will be invested in those new policies. That's actually how the public schools developed in the first place. You know, at the time of the revolution, the period I study most people considered education a family responsibility. And while you had people like Jefferson and Horace Mann and people like that talking about public education, it was the schools themselves that convinced Americans to invest in public schools. As the schools, people sent themselves, their kids to the school, they developed interest in the schools, they wanted their neighbors, wanted access to the schools, and you started to develop new policies to support those schools. Well, we could see the same thing happening in reverse. As, you know, I could imagine I start buying things and I want to have tax deductions for those things, and and next thing you know, we've started down a path that's very different, even if it wasn't initially designed that way. You know, even if initially it was a response to the pandemic, these new interests will lobby. These new interests will have money behind them. These new interests will have new stakeholders, the parents who have bought these services. Mm-hmm. And that's going to have a long-term cost to how we pool resources collectively to educate all American children.
So I think they've hit on something very, very important and something very scary, because in all the attacks on public schools that have been made in the past decade or last 20 years by various forces, including the Gates Foundation, including the Obama administration, and now the Trump administration. The truth has been that the bulwark against them is that many parents actually love their local public schools. And especially, you know, in places where they are well-funded, like the suburbs, they tend to oppose charter schools and vouchers because they realize that they drain funds from their local public schools. But that may change in the future if now, as they are less and less satisfied with the kind of remote education that is being provided. It seems like there's sort of a negative feedback loop here, in that the less confidence we have in the quality of our public schools, the less funding they get, the more funding that is diverted to public options, and the more dysfunctional they become. And it just seems like a very dangerous trend, a negative feedback loop that could take over more areas of the country, as it already has in many of the large cities like New York and Chicago and Washington, D.C., where charter schools are a big part of this, of the education sector. One of the other things that I once heard from a parent in Georgia was that we are in danger of having our public schools become something like our public hospitals, which are sort of relegated to those who can't afford health insurance and you know, a decent health care, so that there will be sort of two kinds of education, one for the poor and disadvantaged, or the people who don't have jobs, the immigrants, and another form of education for middle-class parents. And that would really mean not necessarily an end to public education, but a real diminution and a further decline in the quality of that education because of more and more funding would be taken away from it. What hope do we have of reversing this trend of growing inequities, which then contribute in a negative way to the further push for privatization of public schools? What forces can parents marshal, can elected officials marshal to try to make sure that this nightmare vision does not happen?
Yeah, those are very good questions. And I think you captured what's this negative feedback loop really effectively. And if we look at other parts of the world where, you know, places like South America or Asia, parts of Asia and South Asia where middle-class parents, the norm is to send your child to a private school because the public schools are considered kind of charity schools and lacking the kind of investment and lacking the stakeholders, they kind of languish, kind of like public hospitals in the U.S. That's exactly my fear, that we have this great inequality. We not only lose education as a public good, but that the people who are obliged to have to go to public schools will suddenly find themselves in kind of underfunded, left behind charity schools. And that is dangerous. What can we do to challenge it? I guess there's lots of things, right? One is remembering we don't know the future. I'm worried, but most Americans, as you say, actually love their local public school. Parents are working. They also rely on the public school as a place to send their children to be safe during the day. Homeschooling is, of course, very labor-intensive. I think there's a possibility that people will, you know, if we can come out of this pandemic and start to return safely, we can return to something before these new interests get fully established and start undermining our public schools. I mean, it's worth remembering that the evidence on charter schools and private schools being better is mixed, and a lot of evidence suggests that when you correct for socioeconomic status, public schools perform as well or outperform private schools and charter schools. So there's also the fact that public schools in America do okay. You know, they are certainly competitive as a sector. But the inequality issue is what we have to address, you know, and what the local public schools do is they kind of allow us to channel our interest in our child into a collective investment in other people's children. So by creating these mass institutions, as a parent, I'm willing to pay taxes because my kid is going there, but those taxes are supporting every child, right? And what I fear is if we start to say, well, my child's not in there, why am I paying taxes for this other school? Then we'll have that nightmare scenario of the charity school, which we treat you know, we invest differently in Medicare than we do in Medicaid. We invest differently in middle-class services, right, public services, than we do in charity services in America. And we could see that happening with public schools. I'm hopeful it won't happen. I'm fearful it will, just because you have these longstanding policy goals that were bipartisan. As you said, Obama and Trump have been pushing along similar lines in many ways. And we have this crisis that is forcing parents, middle-class parents, wealthy parents, to take stock and figure out what are they going to do. And you ask for hope. Here's my hope. I think what we could also learn is how dependent we are on these public schools, how much we appreciate them, how necessary they are for our children, how much our children miss them. They miss not just the social, but we miss seeing the teachers and the academic growth. But it could also remind us that we are actually in need, not just in education, but in other places, of investing in public goods again. And so this could also be a turning point in a different way, where this crisis says, look, we Americans depend on the quality of our public institutions, and that quality depends on our willingness to both fund them and participate in them. And when push comes to shove, we want that, you know? And ideally, we'll do that in a way that'll be more egalitarian. Go ahead.
Well, hopefully, I mean, one of the things that has come out through this crisis is how the physical infrastructure of many of our public schools across the country are in poor shape. And there has been a united opposition by the Republican Party for decades to having the federal funds really contribute to infrastructure improvements for our public schools. And I think that that, along with the realization that I mentioned earlier in the show, that many parents for the first time really realized how valuable the public schools were and how terrific a job their public school teachers were doing for their kids, when all of a sudden they were saddled with the responsibility of doing much of that instruction at home, could be a positive turning point. Another turning point that I saw initially was that there's been a huge industry in promoting online learning for the last decade or more, and a very strong industry of ed tech companies and various advocacy groups and foundations that have built up to support the expansion of ed tech. And now with remote learning, a lot of that promotion and PR and spin has been shown to be completely false. And that kids, when they go online and do these programs, whether they're teacher-directed or directed by some sort of app or commercial program, tend to become really disengaged and depressed, and fail to really be engaged in the learning process, that many kids fall off the ladder immediately. And one of the hopes that I had was that this would transform the view that somehow online learning was going to save our schools and was the magic bullet that was going to narrow the achievement gap and make sure that, you know, equalize achievement and equalize learning across the country. And that was something that the Gates Foundation was intent on promoting, as well as many, many other forces, wealthy billionaires and advocacy groups in D.C. and elsewhere. So I was hoping that that might be a positive turning point as well. What do you think about that?
I think I share that hope with you, both for K-12 and higher education. You know, the irony is, of course, companies like Google and Yahoo have been promoting online education while building huge, effectively, campuses for their employees, because they want their employees to work in creative environments and have relationships and really develop and be innovative and all these things. They know it doesn't work, you know? And so they're selling something they know is something they would not want in their own culture and in their own way of doing things. And now it's been exposed at both K-12 and higher ed that face-to-face learning, being in a community of learners, developing relationships with other students and with teachers, the kind of richness of a conversation or a lab or the give and take of a physical space are essential to learning. And so my hope is that you're right, that at least now people will say, okay, online is not the answer. We actually need to invest in the physical infrastructure for learning, both at the K-12 level and in higher education. And this could be a turning point that way as well. I mean, this is a thing about turning points or moments where we don't know the future and it seems unclear. It could go many ways. And I hope with you it goes in a way that, you know, challenges some of these longstanding kind of efforts to undermine our public school systems and actually can develop a new commitment. That would be the ideal outcome. The fear, of course, is that parents making short-term decisions will threaten that possibility. And so we have to sort of be aware of both of these things at the same time.
Right. And we don't know how long the virus will last. We don't know how long it will take to find an effective vaccine and make sure that, you know, a large proportion of our children are vaccinated, which leads us to another mystery about, you know, uncertain future. But I think at this point, we all agree that our schools do need, our public schools need more funding and need more support from the federal government. And I'm just amazed and astonished and outraged that the federal government still has not come up with any money for public schools, even in this crisis, and seems to be deadlocked at this point. So I want to encourage all listeners, wherever you are in the country, to really contact your senators and your congresspeople and urge them to pass this COVID package that we've been waiting for so long. Also in New York specifically, we have many, many billionaires, I think I talked about this on the last show, who have increased their wealth substantially during the 3 months of the pandemic, and we can afford to tax them more and make them pay their fair share to make sure that our schools aren't further cut by 20%, which is what our governor is threatening to do in the future. So I don't know what the situation is in Washington. It seems like you have a pretty good governor who is supportive of the public schools, but I don't know whether they're threatening bigger cuts to your schools as well.
Well, I think Washington, like all states, Washington has no income tax, so we're very dependent on the state of the economy. Like a lot of states, education funding is constitutionally protected, but we're going to go through an economic crisis. And I don't know what kind of pressures that's going to put on our public schools and what kind of pressures it's going to put on parents and teachers. This is a problem that we need the federal government to solve. And their unwillingness and inability to do that has put teachers, public schools, and parents and citizens in a terrible situation. And I share your outrage. It shouldn't be this way.
So thank you so much. I've been talking to Johan Niems, professor at Western Washington University and the author of Democracy Schools, The Rise of Public Education in America, who just published this op-ed in the USA Today that I think everybody should read. I will include it in the resources both on the WBAI website and on the podcast website. He warns that the pandemic school shutdowns may lead to the further privatization of learning and an end to public education in the U.S. And I think we all know that we should do everything in our power to prevent this from happening. Thank you so much for joining us, Professor Niems.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been a pleasure.
Thank you again for your work. Bye-bye, everybody. This is Lainey Hameson, host of Talk Out of School on WBAI 99.5 FM Pacifica. Our show is available as a podcast if you miss live version. For the next 2 weeks, we will have guest host Stuart Chen. and a CUNY professor who teaches counselors in New York City public schools. I will be back on December 2nd. Until then, be careful and be safe, and thanks so much for listening.
Up to the corner and round the bend, right to the juke joint you go in. Drop the coin right into the slot. You gotta hear something that's really hot. With the one you love, you're making romance. All day long you've been wanting to dance.